Hello and welcome to a new episode of New Books in Islamic Studies. I'm your host, Sher Ali Tareen. In her inspiring new book, Muslim Women's Quest for Justice, Gender, Law, and Activism in India, Mengjia Hong Shalayer charts the strivings and creative struggles of Muslim women organizations in contemporary North India for gender justice. Carefully historicized and brimming with nuanced analysis, this book shows the discursive and political strategies through which overlapping and at times competing women organizations navigate a contested and complicated public sphere as they seek to curate a gender emancipatory understanding of Islam. The major strength of this book is the way it presents a vivid picture of the quest for gender justice on the ground, leavened by such critical processes as the composition of gender-just nikanamas. This important new book will engage the interests of a range of scholars and courses on Islam, gender, South Asia, and Islamic law and society. Here now is my conversation with Professor Mengjia Hong Shalayer. Hello, Mengjia. How are you doing?
I'm good. Hi, Sher Ali. How are you?
Very good. Thank you for your time and for coming to New Books in Islamic Studies. Terrific book about a very important subject that not many of us would have known about. So this is a really remarkable exploration that you've done of these Muslim women in Lucknow and in North India. Before we get to the book, Mengjia, a question that is a tradition of New Books in Islamic Studies, which is, could you share with our listeners a bit about how you became a scholar of South Asia, Islam, Muslim societies? What is the story behind your journey?
The book is basically a part of a larger journey that started in 2005 when I did research on a tribal women's court in Udaipur. So I am trained as an anthropologist, and I have also a background in international law. And I have been interested from very early in my studies in South Asia because I've traveled South Asia quite a bit. And I started learning the language at some point, and I also studied under a Indian professor, Shalini Randeria, who's herself a sociologist and legal anthropologist, and kind of directed me to some of the questions that I take up in my book and my previous research. So in 2005, I had the opportunity to go and study a tribal women's court a little bit outside of Udaipur, which was set up by an NGO called ASTA, together with women's rights groups from the MENA community. And what is really unique about this women's court and really fascinated me right from the beginning was that they managed to create a space where the voices of the women were heard and where the cases were brought in a manner that it focused on the well-being of the women rather on ideas of respectability or respect of family and family honor. So the question was obviously, like, how does a women's court in this very context function, which is a very patriarchal context? And as you probably know, we do have the caste panchayats, the jati panchayats are very well functioning and very men-dominated. Women are often not allowed to bring cases to these forums. We think about most cases that reach these forums are cases that pertain to family and marriage, speaking of domestic violence and maintenance and custody, in some cases even rape. Divorce is another big repudiation for marriages. So that's one forum that women cannot access. And another forum that is difficult for women to access are the state courts in Udaipur themselves, which also function in a very patriarchal manner, but more often than not, they're not interested in taking up cases of poor tribal women specifically. So this tribal court has been a wonderful place where they managed to put in the forefront the issues and concerns and lives of women. And how they did it is really interesting because, and that's the uniqueness basically of that court, is that they integrated the Constitution, discourses on the Constitution, national and international frameworks on human and women's rights, and translated them into a local context that makes sense for these women and men who were a part of the discussions and mediations. And if we look at the larger scholarship, specifically on political science and women's studies, who mostly focus on the court, on the state courts, on the state and its responsibility to protect women under the law, we find very little discussion of the validity of community councils, for example, or community forums in regards to women's rights. And similarly, we have a large body of anthropological and sociological work that focuses specifically on community councils, who also do not really ask questions in regards of how they co-play with state courts. So in my research, I kind of tried to break these dichotomies between the state and the community and look very specifically of how women's institution, women's forums in the area of family law become a space where these two entities are merged and hybridized, where we have, again, like discourses on international legal frameworks and constitution that are hybridized, vernacularized in a very specific context. So that brought me to the research on Muslim women's rights activism in Lucknow for my dissertation, where I came across a newspaper article on a Mahila Adalat, Muslim Mahila Adalat in Lucknow. And I packed my bags and I went to Lucknow to kind of do a comparative study between this tribal women's court and the Muslim women's court. So what I found there is less the court, which didn't really exist, because it was more like, it seems, a media enterprise than a reality. But what I found is a large amount of Muslim women's rights organizations who are currently contributing to debates on family law in India. So this is where I come from and my background.
So to begin with a broad question, which is, how would you describe the central argument that you pursue in this book? What is the central point that you make in this book?
I mean, the first central point that I make is that the state is not the only dispenser of justice. The state is not the only place where justice is produced. But there's a variety, specifically in India, like in most post-colonial countries, you have a variety of legal institutions that are less formal but contribute in a very important way to the realization of social justice and women's rights. So looking specifically at Islam and these Muslim women's rights organizations and Muslim family law, I also argue that Islam is not an obstacle to the realization of gender justice and women's rights, as it is often portrayed in modernist scholarship, again, that focuses primarily on the state. In fact, and this is the heart of my research, in fact, women have come forward and spoke or have realized within the framework of Islam ideas of gender justice and women's rights. And again, when we look at the scholarship, a lot of the assumptions that are made is that the Muslim women are the oppressed subject. They do not step out of the house. They don't have a voice. They're mute. They're invisible. And my research shows, and I think very pointedly, that Muslim women do have agency, even if it's not in a classical liberal sense, but they're not stripped of their agency just because they struggle for justice within the framework of Islam. But it is a different form of agency that needs to be accounted for. So these are my three main points, so to speak, that I make in the book.
I was wondering if you could speak a bit more about the context and the actors. So the book is based in Lucknow, and you primarily focus on three major Muslim organizations in Lucknow: the All India Muslim Women's Personal Law Board, the Bharatiya Muslim Mahila Andolan, BMMA, and then Bazme Khawateen. So could you speak a bit about these organizations, some features of them, and the context of Lucknow? Could you contextualize your study a bit?
And so there is no single Muslim community in Lucknow, but they're very diverse in terms of language, in terms of education, in terms of class, in terms of race, in terms of caste. So the oldest women's organizations that I have looked at is a Sunni women's organization, Bazme Khawateen, that was established in 1934 under colonial rule, and basically with the goal to for women to come together as a club and discuss, you know, subjects of Parda and look more specifically at the Quran and how it relates to women. This women's organization has over time become much more of an activist organization, where they actively contribute to debates on women's rights and social justice in India. But they're still very locally organized by gathering women within the city and, again, discussing ideas of family and gender at seminars and workshops. Literacy is another subject that they take up. And more broadly, ideas of Parda, again, but more law-related. And what's interesting is that within the last, I would say, 12 years, there was a proliferation of Muslim organizations in the city, which basically can be understood against a political background of communalism, of the debates that are ongoing in India right now, and have been ongoing since independence on Muslim family law and who really has the authority to speak on behalf of the Muslim community when we think about family law and marriage. The All India Muslim Personal Law Board has taken on the task to speak on behalf of the Muslim community. And the All India Muslim Women's Personal Law Board sees itself as a direct, like, counterplayer for the All India Muslim Personal Law Board, where they directly challenge the authority, the legal authority of the Deobandi. The All India Muslim Women's Personal Law Board itself has been challenged a year later by the establishment of the Bharatiya Muslim Mahila Andolan, the Indian Muslim women's movement, who is more of a secular movement and has come out of the national Indian women's movement. They have been dissatisfied with the underrepresentation of Muslims in the women's movement, but equally dissatisfied with the representation of Muslims on a political level, and have taken it up themselves to speak on behalf of women within a lens of secularism, but using the language of Islam.
So how did these organizations and their leaders, how have they gone about challenging patriarchy and male hegemony in the public sphere? You spent a lot of time discussing and giving us examples of how they've gone about doing that in the book. Could you share with us a couple of examples of how they've done that in the public sphere?
Mm-hmm. So what has been interesting, I think, in Lucknow is in the last few years, these women have become extremely visible within the public sphere, which is a very men-dominated public sphere. I think there have been fatwas released very recently that women should not be allowed in engaging in public religious lives because it would disturb the order of the public sphere. And these women have challenged these various ideas of modesty and gender as it exists within these very patriarchal narratives of Islam, and have made, again, space to make their voices heard. We have the Basme Khwatin, who have established the only women's park in Lucknow. It's a park in the center of old Lucknow that basically features their weekly gatherings, or offers room for their weekly gatherings. Every now and then, the leader, Shehina Sidrat, she guides prayers, namaz, in this park for women, which again is something quite unique in India, where women are not allowed to lead prayers in public. So to challenge, I think, male authority in this regard, and making it visible by inviting the press to talk about it, has made waves in India. Another organization, the All India Muslim Women's Personal Law Board, they have set up their own mosque, a women's mosque just a little bit outside of Lucknow. Again, there is a women's mosque that exists in Tamil Nadu that has been established a few years earlier than the one in Lucknow. But it's a very specific feature that is designed to bring women together within the public sphere and allow them to go to the mosque and give their Friday prayers, something that women in Lucknow, Mochel in India, they don't do, or Muslim women. Again, the All India Muslim Personal Law Board has spoken very vocally against these establishments of Muslim women's mosques, arguing that women do not have a place in public and would disturb the idea of praying peacefully for men because they cannot concentrate anymore. And the Bharatiya Muslim Mahila Andolan, they have challenged the public order in the sense of a marriage that was very unusual. Naish Hassan was married by a women's Ghazi, Sayyida Hamid, who has agreed to perform the marriage after she has sought for permission of different imams outside of India. And this wedding was nationalized through the media. It was a big hype. And it was, as she says, a wedding that has never been seen before in this regard. So this is basically three very specific instances and in how we see how these women have made strides into the public sphere and challenged the male supremacy within this context.
Tell us a bit about these gender-just nikahnamas that you spent quite a bit of time talking about towards the end of your book. Why are they so important to the cause of these Muslim women's organizations and activists in Lucknow? And what sorts of changes have they implemented to traditional nikahnamas to make them more gender-just? Could you give us some examples on that?
Yes. So the discussion on the codification of Muslim personal law, I think, has been ongoing since independence. And we have the Muslim Personal Law Sharia Application Act that regulates marriages or not regulates marriages because it's hardly codified, and which leaves ample room for, again, the Muslim clergy to come up with their own interpretations of the religious text in regards to marriage and the family. Already in the 1990s, there were Muslim women's organizations who have tried to kind of come up with a contract, with a written document that stipulates the right and responsibilities of the spouses within the marital union. We have stipulations in terms of economic rights similar to the Shia personal law board, Nikanama. It also stipulates that women, I know they have more, should be allocated more money beyond the Idat period. It prohibits triple talaq altogether. Again, a practice that is still very prevalent among the Muslim community and is right now discussed. We are awaiting the Supreme Court decision, I think, in July, whether or not it is constitutional. Women, I mean, one of the other rights that's been incorporated is hula, women's right to take divorce from her husband, which is in concordance with the Dissolution of Muslim Marriage Act. So we see kind of an infusion of national or state legislation into these contracts that are not a part of the state. It also declares registrations of marriages mandatory. A lot of marriages are not registered, and women often do not have proof that I have been married to this person. An age of consent of 18 years for women to kind of push against child marriage that is prevalent in India among Muslims and Hindu the same. And also includes the practice of talaq ibain. We also have the nikahnama offered by the Bharatiya Muslim Mahila Andolan is basically a step, from that point of view, a step towards codification of Muslim personal law in India. So they take the constitution and the legal framework that exists already at the national level and translate that directly into the nikahnama. So they have basically outlawed any kind of unilateral divorce. Divorce has to be mutual and has to be based on consent, mutual consent. Again, the age of marriage for women is 18 and for men it's 21, which reflects the CEDAW. The financial rights of women is another important part of that nikahnama. Women very often, when they are rejected from their husband or by their husbands, they end up with hardly anything. And the state does not provide them with financial support. There's no welfare system in place. So the financial rights aspect is a really important part of that nikahnama, where the mehr has been paid at the time of marriage and not later on and cannot be forgiven. The amount of mehr has to be written down in the contract. Women have an equal right to all property that has been accumulated during the time of marriage, which is something that is nowhere stated in the other contracts. Similar to this recent Supreme Court decision, this nikahnama also asks for a lump sum money in case of a divorce that would allow for the woman to live comfortably for a certain amount of time beyond the 3 months of EDUT, and access maintenance payments. So all the contracts have to be registered with a official, but through the governmental registration. The contact information of the husband is included in the Nikanama to make sure that you can find and locate the husband. The amount of money that he makes in his job is also stipulated. So it's a very detailed contract or document that leans very heavily on the constitution, national legal frameworks, but also human and international human and women's rights frameworks.
So as a final substantive question, could you tell us a bit about the policy recommendations that you offer towards the end of your book that are based on your analysis and your research?
I mean, based on the analysis that I did and the findings that I made, is that, again, you know, it is really important to kind of come away from a state-centered focus in discussions and debates and approaches to women's rights more generally and to Muslim women's rights very specifically here. As I have argued also in the chapter 5, where I look more in terms of how family law cases are mediated and adjudicated within the women's organizations themselves, who very often act like little doorstep courts, that these organizations and forums actually are an inherent part of the legal landscape and contribute tremendously to the realization of women's rights on the ground, and very often have way more sway or more impact, direct impact on women's lives than the state courts, who seem either removed or too expensive or are very sluggish and do not work properly, where women have said it takes them up to 12 years to get a divorce, whereas they can get it through the women's organization much faster. So to kind of look at how NGOs and organizations in this regard contribute to the realization of women's rights, I think is really important. And look at them as spaces where the state is not absent, but as spaces where the state is incorporated to some extent in terms of the discourses that they use, the legal discourses, and which creates a true space of interlegality. Speaking of interlegality, and another suggestion that I make is to look at the legal landscape more generally, not in terms of a dichotomy where you have the state courts on the one hand and the non-state courts or the non-state forums, community councils on the other hand, but really look at them as a part of a very complex and dense socio-legal landscape where they cooperate to some extent, but they are in constant in constant conversation with one another, the state de facto acknowledging and accepting the decisions that are made within these non-state legal forums, and the non-state legal forums incorporating state legislations and also draw on the authority of the police and the judges. So to look more at the interaction between these two entities. A third recommendations that I make, also kind of based on my analysis of the cases that have come to these women's organizations, is to kind of shy away or come away from the idea that only classic liberal ideas of justice and equality, how should I put this, are adequate to address women's rights and women's position within society, but that very often these ideas, these very abstract and formal ideas of formal justice, do not hold or do not have a big impact in a context that works very differently, where women are not just individuals, but they're part of a larger social network, and their identities are not just in regards to the state, but also in regards to the family and the larger community. So how can you straddle, again, women's identities that are very diverse? They're wives, they are mothers, they're sisters, and they are a part of the community. And these identities are very often not addressed through these liberal legal frameworks. And again, I think these women's organizations, both in Rajasthan and the ones in Lucknow, have shown that they are a true space of hybridization and vernacularization, that they're not, again, removed from the state or removed from the community, but build a bridge between these different entities and act as a space of conversation also about women's rights and social justice more generally spoken. So to look at these organizations and to incorporate them in efforts of implementing women's rights, I think is really important for establishing social justice on the ground. And last but not least, you know, this doesn't mean that the state does not have any importance anymore, or that we should leave the state out of these conversations, or they don't have, it doesn't have the responsibility to ensure women's rights on the ground, but to just go beyond the state-centered approaches that still are very prevalent in development work.
So as we come towards the end of our time, could you tell us a bit about what's the next project that you will be working on?
Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of this work has been done in the context of, in the post-colonial context, where there's a very strong legal pluralism that exists, so to speak, where we do have different courts that coexist and work on different levels, but we hardly ever think about informal justice and the working of informal justice in Europe or in the US, for example, where again we have a very strong focus on the state legal system. So in my my project that I'm developing right now, which is a project on immigrant Muslim women's rights access to the courts against the background of the war on terror and counterterrorism, where I argue that specifically when looking at New York City, where I currently live, how Muslim women's access to the courts has been hampered and how women navigate that very specific context and what role really like community mosque or neighborhood organizations play for the adjudication specifically of domestic violence cases. Because I do believe in a context of rising Islamophobia, in a context where the relationship between law enforcement and the community is broken, that a lot of women and men do not choose to address the courts, but rather address an organization that's more familiar to them.
Muslim Women's Quest for Justice, Gender, Law and Activism in India, published by Cambridge University Press in 2017. Thank you so much for your time for this wonderful book, which will spark some very important and interesting conversations in multiple fields, including Islamic studies, South Asian studies, and the study of gender, law and society more broadly. So thank you so much for your time and for this opportunity.
Thank you.
So this was my conversation with Menjia Hong Shalayer on her important new book, Muslim Women's Quest for Justice. I hope you enjoyed this conversation. Please also join us next time for another fresh episode of your favorite podcast, New Books in Islamic Studies. Until then, this is your host, Sher Ali Tareen, signing off. Take care, stay well, and keep listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.